Hi, it's Amy Buzzkill from Oregon. In Willamette Damn It, we'd love to hear Professor Buzzkill bust myths and take names.
Yes, Buzzkillers, it's me. It's Professor Buzzkill. Unfortunately for you, you don't have to listen to me today. We are interviewing Kathleen Stone, who's written this great new book called They Called Us Girls, which fits in with so many of the things we like to do on the show. It talks about important people from the past who deserve more fame and glory and deserve more attention, but for whatever reason, they've been overlooked somewhat. So let me start off by saying, Kathleen, thank you for coming on the show.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you.
I think it's important for our listeners to know that you talk about these women that you discuss in detail, and you talk about the period from suffrage to Mad Men. And I thought that was very interesting because, of course, so many people asked me questions about when Mad Men came out. So many people asked me questions like, well, is that what things were like in the 50s and 60s? What do historians say? The gender relations were terrible. Was that sort of a point that you decided the book was really a great place to bring it to a culmination?
Well, yes. And really the Mad Men reference came from one of the women, a woman, Frida Garcia, who I think we'll talk about in a little bit. She worked on Madison Avenue for a teenage girl magazine in the 1950s. And she described what the atmosphere was like, and she compared it directly to Mad Men. So when I was thinking about how to arrange the biographical portraits in the book, it struck me that some of the women were born just before suffrage, and some of them a little bit after, but their life stories describe that period of time from basically 1920 into the 70s. But right. Culminating in the locked-in gender relationships that's portrayed on the TV show Mad Men.
Well, and there are seven women discussed in the book that are artists, physicians, intelligence officers, scientists, all sorts of things, federal judge. We'd like to talk about three of them today because, well, in the first place, we want Buzzkillers to get the book, right, to read the whole thing. So we don't want to give the entire story away. But also, these three that we've chosen really sort of illuminate very different but also very gripping aspects of women's history in the 20th century. So let's start right off, if you don't mind, the physician Dr. Muriel Pettione.
Right.
She's the first, not the first one you talk about, but one of the first ones I think our listeners would like to hear about.
Yes, Muriel Pettione was, I'll just give you basic thumbnail sketch, was born in 1914 in Trinidad. She sailed into Ellis Island at age 5 with her mother and sister. Her father was already here. He had been here for a year already, getting established and finding an apartment. And they moved to Harlem just as the Harlem Renaissance was really flowering in 1919. And that's where she grew up. She became a physician, as her father was. She attended a medical school at Howard University, and she was the only woman in her medical school class in 1937. And just to put that accomplishment in context, not only was she the only woman in her class, but at that time in the United States, about 5% of the country's doctors were women.
Yes, it's amazing.
Only 5%. And among Black doctors, I would say the percentage was even lower. And that's a reflection of the unequal educational opportunities offered to Black children.
Yes, but of course you say her father was a doctor. So I'm wondering how much of that sort of upbringing experience sort of affected her career choice and then her determination to push through.
The short answer is huge. Impact. In fact, when I went to visit, I interviewed Muriel when she was in her 90s, and I took the train to New York and I went to visit her in her apartment. And as we were sitting down in her living room about to start the interview, she said, "You can't talk to me if we don't talk about my father."
Wow.
Indicating he was a forceful figure in his own right and a very influential man on her as his daughter. He had been a journalist in Trinidad. Trinidad at the time was a colony of Great Britain, but he was writing articles against colonialism. And he was, as she put it, invited to leave. That's what prompted him to go to New York. When he arrived with a plan, he decided he wanted to become a doctor. It would be, as he put it, a liberating profession for him. It would give him and the family some financial security, and it would give him some cover so that he could continue to speak out about his political views while being an established, respected member of the community. And that was, I think, very influential for Muriel, both in terms of becoming a doctor herself, but also about combining her professional work with community activism. Mm-hmm. She was very active in the Harlem community throughout her career, and also very involved with a number of national organizations that support Black women and Black professionals.
Now, when you interviewed her, did she concentrate on different particular parts of her career? For instance, did she talk about how difficult medical school was, how difficult it was for a woman like her in medical school? Or did she really go on to talk more about her actual work?
She talked about her work. She did not emphasize the difficulties. And it's interesting. I wanted to interview Muriel in part because I wanted to find out what it was like, not only for a woman, but for a Black woman to navigate away from traditional expectations for women. And she certainly described what it was like growing up in Harlem, and knowing full well that she and her family probably could not have lived in every community in the United States. For sure, they couldn't have. Harlem was one where they, not the only one, but certainly was, at that point, a community of largely Black population. Right. She went to Howard Medical School because most so-called white schools did not accept Black students. Some did, but it was very difficult to be accepted at a so-called white school if you were an aspiring Black doctor. And then her first several jobs out of medical, she did intern at Harlem Hospital in 1937, but even that was remarkable because Harlem Hospital had only fairly recently desegregated its medical staff. So that she was navigating a path for a Black doctor, but knowing full well what the limitations were for her as a Black woman. On the other hand, she was telling me as a matter of fact, but not as a way of complaining. And when I asked her about the combination of being both Black and female and how that might have limited her opportunities, she said, well, I was middle class. I grew up in a middle class educated family. And that, as she put it, that got rid of a lot of that Black woman stuff. I say that in quotes. Those were her words.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And did she find that was able to, is that one of the things she attributes her success during her working career? For instance, she was able to feel like she was talking with other doctors on an equals class level, social level. She was able to supervise nurses adequately because of her background. That sort of thing. Did she feel that class and her education and upbringing were really her major distinguishing characteristics?
I would say yes. She told me she'd grown up in a middle-class family. Her father, as I had previously said, was very active politically, and their home was a site of a lot of neighborhood meetings and meetings of his colleagues in various political and community endeavors. So she grew up hearing his colleagues, some of whom were doctors, other ministers, other educated professionals, in their living room talking about issues. They talked about books at home. She went to a very good high school, Wadley School, which was a high school for girls in Harlem, which was very highly regarded at the time. And then she went to Howard. And her father insisted that she and her brother and sister go to college, so that education and middle-class values were very strongly promoted within her family. And she attributed a lot of her success later in life to having had that kind of upbringing.
And how does she describe to you the sort of changes in gender relations and the changes in women as professionals during her working decades, which I'm off the top of my head thinking it's the, you know, 40s, 50s, 60s.
Yes, definitely that period of time. And also into the 70s. She worked.
Yeah.
She cut back on her private practice after a while, but she remained very active in the medical community and in the Harlem community.
But she must have seen enormous changes around her all the time.
Absolutely. And I'll give you one example. As I said, when she was the only woman in her class in medical school, and she described mm-hmm. to me the atmosphere of women doctors, not specifically at Howard Medical School, but just in the medical community in general, were not entirely accepted. They were just a tiny minority. And some of the male doctors were not entirely thrilled about having women infiltrating their region. But in the 1970s, as I think we all know from knowing something about American history, there was a big surge of women into professional jobs and graduate schools. And that was true for Black women as well as white women. And Muriel described in the 1970s getting calls from hospitals and other employers around the country. She was a known name within Black medical circles by that time. She was getting calls from people who were interested in meeting affirmative action hiring goals and were looking to hire Black female doctors. And Muriel decided that what she could do to help that process was create a professional networking organization for Black women doctors. And she started something called the Dr. Susan Smith McKinney Steward Medical Society. It was an organization named in honor of the doctor who was the first Black woman doctor in New York State. And Muriel described in some detail the first meeting of this organization. She said 40 or 50 women showed up at a meeting site in New York. And the young women came with long hair and wearing open-toed sandals and nail polish on their toes. And she found that remarkable because she said when she had started out in the profession, women had to be very circumspect and sort of put their womanhood under wraps, under their white coat, mm-hmm. so to speak, because otherwise the men wouldn't accept them. And she felt a thrill at seeing these younger women doctors showing themselves as women and with their hair and their nail polish. It may sound superficial to talk about nail polish, but I can assure you that Muriel was not at all superficial in how she approached the idea of women in medicine. It was something she cared deeply about, but it was indicative to her of some of the changes that had happened in the intervening 40 years.
Well, and of course, those sorts of changes in dress and fashion and acceptance of dress and fashion practices is a huge change in American life.
It is. And it's obviously one that's still continuing.
Yeah, and it stuck with her in her mind because she saw that as a clear transformation.
Absolutely.
Well, the second woman who grabbed my attention so strongly was Cordelia Dodson Hood, who had been an intelligence officer in the military, and we have talked about various female intelligence officers or spies or women in the military in World War II especially, but she was, you call this chapter, a unique wartime opportunity. This is a unique wartime opportunity partly because she's a unique wartime woman.
She was. She had several jobs during the war years. She worked for Office of Facts and Figures first. And then she worked for the Pentagon. And then she finally got the job that she wanted, which was in OSS.
Mm-hmm.
She very much wanted to go to Europe, where she thought she could be most effective in helping the United States win the war, partly because she was fluent in German. And she thought that she could use her skills best for OSS over there. She also had a very analytical turn of mind. That was true, no matter what she was doing or learning. But as when she was working for OSS, well, first of all, most women in OSS were in the clerical ranks. And she distinguished herself with her analytical turn of mind, as I said, as an officer. She wasn't a spy per se. She was an intelligence analyst and officer, and she was analyzing German communiques to find out what the Germans were up to and then reporting that back to the government in Washington. And she did that first in London for OSS and then in Bern, Switzerland, which is where the OSS European headquarters were located.
And how did she, first of all, decide that she was, and she obviously knew she had a very analytical turn of mind, but you know, you can have an analytical turn of mind without thinking necessarily, well, I should go into specifically OSS. How did that sort of jump out at her as the place where she could do her best work?
Well, as I said, not only did she was fluent in German. She had studied German in college, and then she had spent a year or two after college traveling in Europe, first in France, where she perfected her French, and then in Germany and Austria, where she perfected her German, so that she had this language skill. She was in Austria in the winter of 1938. And absolutely, she arrived when just before the Nazis really took over the country.
Crucial time to be there.
And she and her siblings, she was with her two brother and sister, they were studying at the university and she was taking more advanced German classes right there. And they joined in the student protests that were going on throughout the city. And they marched and chanted with the Austrian students. And she told me the chant that she remembered was red, white, red until we're dead. Red and white being the colors of the Austrian flag. And the students were hopeful that they could somehow fend off Hitler with their political protests. One night they went to the opera. And if you know the Vienna State Opera House, you know it was built in the grand imperial style. And patrons got very dressed up to go to the opera. Women wore their long dresses. They drank champagne at intermission.
Oh, sure, yeah.
So these three Americans went to the cheap seats in the upper level. And at intermission, they walked through the lobby and out to the balcony to get some fresh air. And they saw for the first time the Austrian police riding around in their open cars, but wearing swastika armbands. And they knew that at that point, the Nazis had in fact taken over Austria and Hitler's proposed Anschluss had in fact become a reality. So that experience, she knew right then that she wanted to do something. She knew that the Nazis were bad news and she wanted to do something when the time came to help America in the war. Shortly after that, a friend of theirs who was an Austrian medical student who was Jewish was arrested and imprisoned at Dachau. And again, that only strengthened her resolve to fight. And so when Pearl Harbor happened and the United States entered the war, she went to work for the war effort.
Yeah, but she was able to make her way out of Austria. It wasn't, I presume she left soon enough after the Anschluss that it wasn't a sort of problem or restriction and escape through a net that the Nazis had thrown up around the country.
She actually spent the rest of that year there.
Or
most of the rest of that year. She and her sister arrived home in the fall of 1938.
Right.
And the obstacle they faced was getting a ship. They weren't, as Americans, they were, I don't think that they were particularly inhibited by the Nazis weren't particularly after them. And she was not Jewish. So she wasn't
right.
Particularly vulnerable on that score, but they had, some of the harbors were mined by that point and they had to find a safe passage out of the country, but they did.
How did she describe then how she navigated the OSS hierarchy, the government hierarchy, the military hierarchy? We just assume as historians that it must have been extremely difficult and they must have been, and women must have been sort of pushing against obstacles all the time.
I think that's true. Now, she had what OSS was looking for. She had language
right.
skills. She knew something about Europe, having already traveled there. She was educated. So she really had what they, and she also had, she had learned the Swiss German dialect, which would become pivotal in her experience with OSS, because once she got to Bern, she was able to talk to the Swiss Federal Police, which, and nobody else in the office had that dialect, but she did.
We tend to forget about that part of World War II. It's really important, Swiss German, yeah.
Yeah. So that was critical to her success in OSS. However, when she was first recruited by OSS, there were two barriers. One was she couldn't be in any overt way recruited by OSS because the government agencies had a no-raid pact. No one agency could raid employees from another agency. She was already working for the Pentagon at that point.
Right.
She had to quit her job with the Pentagon and be unemployed for several months before she could actually jump ship and go work for OSS. The second obstacle she faced was, despite the fact she had the qualifications that they very much needed, she had to take a typing test. And I asked her if everybody had to take a typing test. And she, as she said, no, that was reserved for girls. And I use her word.
It's almost as if they were saying, you know, well, in a crunch, we might need you to dictate, to take down some dictation or something.
Well, most women were actually hired to be secretaries or clerks. She was one of the few who progressed into the officer ranks.
Yeah.
And she almost failed the typing test. She was a poor she was a poor typist, but they let her keep her job anyway, which she said thrilled her. So she took a ship to London, and when she got to London, they said, "All right, well, welcome, but before you can do any work, we want you to take that typing test again." So she had to try again.
And what was it like to be? I mean, this goes for all intelligence officers and cryptographers and things like people that sort of line of information. What was it like to be? I mean, they know everything first. They know it before the military. They know. You know, they're the ones who have to tell the government higher ups what was going on. I wonder if she conveyed to you any sense of, you know, the tension must have been very strong to be saying, I have to get this absolutely right all the time because troop movements are going to depend on this or supply shipments are going to depend on this. I mean, it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. All of that is absolutely true. I think she took that pressure somewhat in stride, but she did describe many late nights working in the office, translating German language documents, summarizing the contents in memos that would go to Washington, and as she said, pecking out with her two-fingered typing the memo that would then go to Washington, and trying to get it into the diplomatic pouch that would make safe transit to Washington. So she did say that there were a lot of late nights doing just that kind of work because it was critical to get that information back to Washington headquarters.
And making a slip up, you know, transposing the numbers in a degrees of latitude or longitude or whatever it's being, could very well be fatal.
It could be. She was detail oriented. So she would have intuitively double checked all of those kinds of things before putting something in a memo.
And then did the OSS or the government turn around and recognize these intelligence officers in special ways? I mean, were there medals? Were there maybe promotions? Maybe not. But is it one of those things where it just has to remain so secret that you don't know even after the war you're supposed to keep your mouth shut?
Yes. And after the war, actually, Cordelia worked for CIA. And the oath of secrecy was very much inbred with her. And when I was interviewing her, she was in her 90s, and a lot of CIA documents had been declassified by that time. And there, of course, there had been investigations into some unsavory doings of CIA, and there had been congressional hearings, and a lot of stuff had come out into the public. She had a hard time with seeing all of that in the public because the notion of confidentiality was was what was natural to her. No, I don't mean to say that she condoned some of the CIA's efforts to overturn governments or to keep dictators in power, but the confidentiality piece of CIA's work was something that she prized and took as the way it should be.
And what about her co-workers at that level? It seems to me that in the public mind, we have this idea of, you know, intelligence transcribers, for instance, at Bletchley Park in Britain, the famous Wrens, the Women's Royal Navy auxiliary who transcribed the German Enigma transmissions. And we have this sense that there's a whole group of analysts. There was Joan Clark and various people like that. I just wonder what sort of camaraderie there might have been between intelligence officers and between intelligence officers at her level of different genders. Did she talk about that at all?
I think there was a great deal of socializing. Uh-huh. In fact, I saw some pictures of Cordelia during those years, and including some office parties. And despite the fact it was a deadly serious war and they were engaged in deadly serious work, they were also having some fun socializing.
Well, and I imagine that the stress has to be relieved somehow, and that's probably the best way.
Yeah. And she also described the atmosphere, this was particularly in Bern, Switzerland, as all kinds of people were coming. As soon as the Allies controlled the borders, there could be more freedom of movement of people in. For many years, the Germans had controlled the borders, mm-hmm. and nobody could get in or out of Switzerland. But late in the war, the Allies had pushed the Germans back, and the Allies controlled the borders. So Americans and other Allies could get into Switzerland, and so a lot of American OSS officers were coming in on all kinds of missions. Some were there to build community with Italian partisans. Some were there to infiltrate labor lawyers. They were just there for any number of reasons to do anything they could to build networks of people who would be helpful in overthrowing the Nazis however they could. So there was all that kind of people coming in. But she also said that finally, once the borders were open and Americans could come in, they got a secretary from New York who finally organized the office. Instead of having people like her hunting and pecking on the typewriter, they finally had someone who could type and all who right. could organize everybody. And as she said, everybody socialized together. It sounded, obviously there was a hierarchy. Alan Dulles was in charge of the headquarters in Europe. But between the socializing and everybody just doing whatever had to be done to get the job done, I think that it was not a strict hierarchical situation.
Well, and last but certainly not least, and certainly the most perhaps media friendly one, what I'd like to talk about is Frida Garcia, the advertising woman who had worked on Madison Avenue.
Yes.
And you have her not only doing that, but also as a nonprofit leader. But I don't want to give away too much of the story. Your description of her career in this chapter is absolutely fascinating.
Oh, thank you. Frida actually is a neighbor of mine, although I did not know her before I approached her for an interview. We both live in Boston, and she's mm-hmm. just a few blocks from me. But I knew her name because there's a city park named in her honor, the Frida Garcia Park, and it's very close mm-hmm. to where I live. So I certainly knew her name from just living in Boston. But I didn't have her email address, and I didn't know exactly where she lived. So I had to do some sleuthing to find her. But I did. I was given an introduction to her. And when I approached Frida about whether she'd be willing to be interviewed for my book, at first she was reluctant. Partly she's humble, and partly she said, and I'll use her words, this cultural thing is going to interfere with my story. I didn't know exactly what she meant by that, but of course, saying something like that made her all the more intriguing to me, because I very much did want to know what navigating a woman's unconventional path was like for a Latina woman. And specifically, she was born in the Dominican Republic. She came to this country when she was 8, and some of her experience was colored by her Dominican family. Do you want me to fill in some of the details about her life?
Yeah, tell the whole thing. Yeah,
she grew up in Manhattan. She was probably 11 or 12 in public school when she said she thought she was sort of being demoted. The teachers in school thought that she should be in what she called the commercial class so that she could become a secretary.
Right.
And that wasn't what she envisioned for herself. Her family did think that would be an appropriate job for her, but she was very intellectual, very interested in reading. She said that going to the public library was one of the things that saved her, having access to books. And she met a friend of the family who was at a private girls' Catholic school in New Jersey, and she decided that's what she wanted to do. So she convinced her mother that she ought to be able to go to this school also. And as she put it, she was very headstrong. Her mother wasn't initially enthused about the idea, and it was a struggle financially to send her there, but her mother worked in a factory and occasionally got some money sent from the Dominican Republic from her family, and did manage to send Frida to St. Dominic Academy in Caldwell, New Jersey. And there, initially, Frida was very unhappy. She was unhappy being away from home, but she, after a few months, realized that it was a great opportunity for her. And as she said, she began to learn about American life. Her mother, although living in New York, surrounded Frida with as much of a Dominican environment as she could. She said all the food was Dominican, their friends were all Dominican, and away at boarding school, Frida was able to learn about American life. And she said for the first time she tasted applesauce.
Oh,
and right. How much she loved applesauce, and that was something her mother had never served at home. So it sounds so simple, something like applesauce, but for her it was sort of a part of her awakening to, wow, there's this whole other life here. And she hungered to learn more about it. And in terms of education, she wanted more. And the nuns, in fact, convinced her mother that she ought to be able to go to college. The nun said, Frida is college material. So she started college at Fordham. But that was interrupted when she met a young Dominican man and decided to get married. And she dropped out of college, and she and this young man lived with her in her mother's apartment with her mother until John's father lived in the Dominican Republic and was running a cattle farm in the Dominican Republic and wanted John to work on the farm. So he did some training on a cattle farm in Florida, and then Frida and he went to the Dominican Republic out into the middle of the countryside, and he worked on his family's cattle farm. Frida, meanwhile, didn't really do farm work, but she started a school for the children of the farm workers. And in a way, that began her professional life. She felt a calling to work with young people and to help people with their education and to provide a range of social services, which is what she was sort of doing on an ad hoc basis on this cattle farm. That part of her life, however, came to an end when her husband came to her and said that he was going to have an affair with a young woman in town. And she was a virgin. And what did Frida think about the fact that he was about to undertake a sexual affair with this virgin woman? And she decided she had had enough of that. And she left the cattle farm. She got divorced. She returned to New York, where, as she said, by her family's traditional standards, her life was over.
Oh, yeah, I can imagine.
A divorced woman, no college education, no job, her life was over. However, it was far from over in reality. She got a job as a secretary working for a magazine called Teen Time, which was a sort of a teenage girl magazine with lots of stories about movie stars. She became a secretary and she went back to college. She finished her degree going nights to the New School for Social Research. She remarried and eventually moved to Boston with her second husband. She found Boston, as she said, to be a pretty mean place. Certainly that, I think it was that way in a physical sense. It was undergoing redevelopment and was not as lovely a city as it is in some ways today. But what she really meant was that she found that there was some resistance to a Latina woman looking for a job in social services. She described an interview she had with the city welfare department. She was bilingual. She had already gotten experience when she and her then husband lived in Chicago working in welfare. But the woman for the city of Boston welfare department said, spent the entire interview trying to figure out how a woman like her could be married to someone who was in graduate school at Harvard.
Wow.
So she was encountering some pretty entrenched attitudes about women and about Latina women.
Yeah, the assumptions are, astounding. They do loom up. The assumptions that other people are making it all the way through, all these careers are just amazing.
Absolutely. And that was one reason I wanted to interview Frida, as well as Muriel Petione, to look at it not only from a white woman's point of view, but from other ethnic points of view as well.
How does she then get into, she becomes a nonprofit leader. And I think that's an extremely important distinction, especially when grouped with the other women in the book.
Yes. She had a really unusual ability to forge connections. And she managed to create connections with the mayor's office through her social service work and with the governor's office in Massachusetts. She got to know the city councilors. So she had a presence in the political landscape, but she also had a presence in the nonprofit community. She served as executive director for something called United South End Settlements, which was a consolidation of some of the original settlement houses in Boston into a social service agency. And she was the executive director for about 20 years. So she had this executive leadership position, but it also allowed her to take an active role in various other nonprofits. She was recruited, if you can believe this, she was recruited by about 75 boards throughout Massachusetts and Boston. Amazing. To serve on their boards. And that's an incredible number. And as she put it, in some of them, it was just window dressing. They wanted either a woman or a Latina woman. But some of them were real work. She was chair of the Boston Foundation, which is a very esteemed nonprofit in Boston. She was on the United Way board. She was on the board of the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum. These are the kinds of boards that usually recruit people either because they themselves have deep pockets or they're affiliated with an institution that has a deep pocket, perhaps their employer. She didn't have that. She didn't have deep pockets herself, and she was executive director of a somewhat struggling social service agency, but she was recruited because she had forged incredible connections throughout the city and she had executive leadership ability, which she had developed on the job. And that's the kind of thing that these nonprofits needed as well.
Well, I'd like to wrap up the interview by asking about these intermezzo that you put in between the chapters. Well, there's a wonderful sense of where not only the book is going in terms of the women that you're interviewing, but where it's going in terms of how you're taking this in as an interviewer, as a researcher, and as someone who's then conveying it to the reading public. It's not so common that you find this in a lot of books that are case studies, if you will, of various people. I just wonder, first of all, how you came up with that device, the way of doing it, and how you think it helps the book along.
Well, to answer your first question, how I came up with it was really after a lot of struggle. It was not my first approach. My first approach was to be probably drier, completely in the third person.
Yeah.
As is most typical biography. And I did a lot of research. I took oral histories from these women, and I didn't want to insert myself in a way that would diminish the factual basis for their life stories. But I did think that as a professional woman myself, and I practiced law for many years, I thought that I might bring some perspective. But it was really, I came to that conclusion only after I was at Bennington writing seminars to get my MFA and was workshopping various pieces of what I, very, very early drafts of what became chapters in the book. And my classmates in workshop convinced me that they wanted me to put myself in there as to help them navigate the path, to give some personal observations of what I had seen or noticed during an interview, but also share some of my own experiences as a lawyer and how that helped me compare and contrast life for women of my generation with life of these other women, who all of whom were of my mother's generation.
Well, it really does make a huge difference in the book. I read an awful lot of biographical things, and this lifts the whole structure and everything, makes it immensely more, well, so much more immediate. I even think the different chapters sink in better because of the intermezzo. It's as if, yes, you understand Cordelia more because of what's the intermezzo between what you call between her chapter, the fourth grade fantasy, and the one after, which you call After Dinner. Just makes all of that fit more and makes the book much more memorable.
Well, thank you. You know, the After Dinner intermezzo relates to the practice of, after a group dinner, the men separating themselves and talking about politics and current events, and the women going into the kitchen to do the dishes. And Cordelia faced that, even though she was as competent an intelligence analyst as any of the men at the dinners that she participated in, she was faced with whether it's just go with the men and talk about business or to go with the women and help do the dishes. And it's something that I faced as well. So as much as some things had changed between her time and my time, some things had not changed. And I have nothing against doing the dishes. I do them frequently, of course, but it was just that demarcation in a social situation between the men's role and the woman's role that in some ways hadn't changed much.
No, I think that the Buzzkillers are going to be really taken with not only the chapters are wonderful in and of themselves, but also this approach really, really makes the book glitter. So it just remains for me to say, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you. It's been great to be with you.
The book.
I love your podcast. Thank you. I love your social media presence, and it's a thrill to be with you.
Yes, and we follow each other on Twitter. Buzzkillers should know. We're both fans of each other. The book is on the Buzzkill bookshelf in the blog post, and our Patreon members can apply to get a complimentary copy. And again, just one more time, thank you so much. And we hope you're working on a new book and that you'll come on the show again when that one's finished.
Thank you. I have a few ideas and we'll be in touch. Thank you so much.
Okay. And Buzzkillers, we will talk to all of you next week.